This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. A court in Pakistan today sentenced to death a 33-year-old scholar charged with blasphemy. The trial lasted 6 years, mired by delays, one caused by the murder of a defense lawyer. Junaid Hafiz was charged with insulting the religious beliefs of Pakistani Muslims. His family and lawyers claim the counts against him were fabricated and resulted from politics at the university, where he was a visiting lecturer. The Independent Human Rights Commission of Pakistan expressed dismay at the court's decision. In Australia, strong winds and high temperatures are helping to spread massive bushfires through the state of New South Wales. Shane Fitzsimmons is the commissioner of the state's Rural Fire Service.
Catastrophic fire dangers are as bad as it gets. These are the very worst of conditions, and given that we've got a landscape with so much fire active and burning in it, you've got a recipe for very serious concern.
Some major roads to the south and west from Sydney are closed, and authorities are asking people to put off holiday travel. The Premier of New South Wales is Gladys Berejiklian.
We are expecting very difficult circumstances, situation today in relation to all of the fire fronts. As you know, it is a catastrophic definition today, which means at very short notice, any of the fire fronts that are active can become very dangerous in a short amount of time.
The deployment of 10,000 personnel is said to be the largest such emergency response ever seen in New South Wales. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi called a meeting with his Council of Ministers today. It comes amid violent protests against a hugely controversial law on citizenship. More than a dozen people, three today, have been killed in clashes with police since Parliament passed the measure. It allows illegal non-Muslim immigrants from neighboring countries an easier path to Indian naturalization. It is the most serious show of dissent against Modi's Hindu nationalist government since he was elected in 2014. From Washington, this is VOA News. Syrian civil defense workers in embattled Idlib province say at least seven people died today in a suspected drone attack, one of two simultaneous air assaults. The targets were said to be oil and gas installations. Pope Francis warns rigidity in living out the Christian faith is creating a minefield of hatred and misunderstanding in a world where Christianity could be increasingly irrelevant. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Francis is calling for Vatican bureaucrats to embrace change during his annual Christmas greetings. The pontiff's message appears aimed at conservative and traditionalist Catholics who voiced increased opposition to his progressive-minded papacy. In particular, he's issued a stark reality check to the men in the Sala Clementina of the Apostolic Palace.
Non siamo più in un regime.
Acknowledging that Christianity no longer holds the commanding presence in society it once did, Francis reminds, tradition is not static, it's dynamic. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
The UN Human Rights Office warns that a new Polish law, which makes it easier to fire judges, poses the risk of further undermining the independence of the judiciary. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN officials say the law puts further constraints on the independence of judges by restricting their fundamental rights to freedom of association and freedom of expression. UN human rights spokesperson Rupert Colville says judges should not be politicized and should not bring politics into the court. Nevertheless, he tells VOA, just like everybody else, judges have a right to hold their opinions and seek membership in associations of their choosing. He notes the new law seriously restricts these activities.
And of course, the overall effect of that is really a very chilling effect on the judiciary. It's so restrictive that it may impact very much on their willingness to get involved in important and legitimate legal arguments and discussions.
Lisa Schlein filed that report for VOA from Geneva. Hotel owners in Venice are urging tourists to visit the iconic Italian city once again, with last month's flooding, despite the damages, now just a bad memory. Here is Sabina Castelfranco in Rome.
The Venice Hotel Association is calling on tourists all over the world to come to Venice to see for themselves the beauty of a city that has always lived with high tides, which hoteliers stressed come and go. They fear that the many cancellations received by hotels following the extraordinary high tide of November 12th has scared tourists away.
That was Sabina Castelfranco for VOA in Rome. Gene Randall, VOA News.
morning and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
A new administration is at liberty to introduce its own policies. So when he did it, I just said, well, that's fine. You know, he's the president today. You know, if he wants to bring about those policy changes, you know, he's quite entitled to do so.
Former President Ian Khama denies instructing the Bank of Botswana to deposit monies into offshore accounts.
The ball is in their court to prove to the people of South Sudan and the international community that they adhere to implement this peace agreement. But we urge them, actually, to commit and have a political will to implement this agreement.
The SPLM-IO says it is waiting for the lifting of sanctions to allow former Sudanese Vice President Riek Machar free movement.
Since the president is the one who went beyond what is allowed by the Constitution, we think that he can no longer give any order, and nobody is obligated to follow an order he may be giving that is illegal.
And opposition parties in Guinea vow to resist attempt to pave way for President Alpha Condé to seek additional terms in office. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Seretse Khama, Ian Khama, the former Botswana president, says he plans to seek legal redress after he was accused of corruption. Local media reports say while President Khama allegedly instructed the Bank of Botswana to transfer billions of local currency of pula or millions of dollars into offshore accounts, an accusation the former president sharply denies. The former president fell out with President Masisi over sharp policy differences. This led to Khama's resignation from the ruling Botswana Democratic Party or BDP. For reaction to the accusation that he instructed the Bank of Botswana to transfer monies to his offshore accounts, I reached former President Seretse Khama, Ian Khama.
Now, saying that I'm displeased is putting it mildly, actually. You know, if it wasn't such a ridiculous accusation, you know, it would be laughable. And what they were saying was that I had given an instruction to the Bank of Botswana, the national bank, to take out billions in our currency and have it deposited in offshore accounts. So that was an actual affidavit that someone in the government put out. And the only reason that this was done was because a few months ago, I resigned from the ruling party because they had abandoned our democratic credentials that we have had such a good reputation with up to this point in time. And we had an election a couple of months ago, and I was campaigning against the ruling party alongside the opposition. And they swore that they would get at me and fix me, in their own words, for having done that. And so what do? They come out with an allegation that 2 months into my presidency, about 11 years ago, I had given that instruction I've just outlined to you. And they also blamed about three or four other people in the same affidavit for having benefited from the same.
Are you therefore going to seek legal redress concerning these allegations that you said are untrue?
That goes without saying. First of all, these people we've engaged are going to put out a report, which we will make public, which will indicate that this was just a scam on their part. Then we have all agreed, the five of us involved with our lawyers, we formed a team, and we are going to sue the government for what they've done. And further to that, we are actually going to lay criminal charges against those individuals in the government who were behind this.
Now, so, Mr. President, what caused the fallout between yourself and your predecessor? You were a team. You were more like brothers. You literally, as Botswana people tell me, you handpicked him because you found him competent to lead Botswana. You gave him your blessing. So what led to the misunderstanding?
You know, that is a question many of us ask ourselves. Because at that time, precisely what you said about him, I had no reason to think that the person who I had selected to be my vice president, who then became my successor, was the kind of person he has turned out to be. You know, all I can put it down to is that he became drunk on power. And we've seen this in one or two other countries, not only on this continent, but elsewhere, even over there in the United States. Take Donald Trump, although in his case, we saw it coming during his campaign towards the 2016 elections. You knew exactly what kind of person you were getting. But in this case, we just didn't see it coming. And so many people, even those close to him, just said, no, this is a character. He's just, you know, as soon as he got into power, as soon as he assumed the presidency, it was all about himself. It was all of it driven by self-interest and then to do away with anything that his predecessor had. You know, and this is what I can see. But part of that question, you'd have to ask them, because it's just something I've never, ever experienced in my life. Someone who's gone through a character change like he has and is prepared to take this country's reputation and rub it in the dirt.
Well, Mr. President, so is there a way that the two of you can reconcile and bury the hatchet? Are there people that both of you respect, elders in Botswana, that can bring both of you together and address this concern? Because a lot of Botswanans are telling me that the two of you being at loggerheads affect everybody in the country.
That is quite true. And it's very sad and unfortunate and regrettable that that happens to be the situation. There have been elders, there have been other people, groups of people and individuals who have tried to do that. But you know what stops it? Every time we think they are making progress, they are then going to do something to intimidate or to harass or to provoke me, which then scuttles the whole effort. And I think it's deliberate, you know, when they do it like that. It's almost like he doesn't want reconciliation. And you know, this particular thing we are talking about right now is a case in point whereby, you know, there were some who came just before the election to try and get this reconciliation effort going. And then they go and preside over a fabrication of evidence against me and other people who are close to me. So under those circumstances, it's so difficult.
Mr. President, some people are suggesting that the fallout came because of sharp policy differences. In the case of some hunting restrictions that you imposed while you were in office, those restrictions have been lifted. What is your reaction to these speculations being peddled around?
I will be quite honest with you that some of these policy changes that he's made, I don't agree with. But what is strange is that he was very much in support and a driver of these same policies when he was my vice president. And all people are saying, including myself, is that these policy changes are more brought about by these differences that he and I have been having. So to sort of like get at me, it's a sort of like Trump-Obama scenario where he just wants to try and say that, no, anything Obama did, Trump has decided that he must bury. Now, in this case, I'm mature enough and I've been in politics long enough and I was a president myself, that a president, a new administration, is at liberty to introduce its own policies. So when he did it, I just said, well, that's fine. You know, he's the president today. You know, if he wants to bring about those policy changes, you know, he's quite entitled to do so. I did the same thing. So who am I to try and challenge them? I may not like them. I mean, as you know, in any nation, when a new government or administration come in, they'll introduce policies. People will like them or they won't like them. But they're the people who have been put in there. Let them have an opportunity to proceed with them and hopefully they'll work out. But that certainly was not the reason which caused these differences.
Serete Kama, Ian Kama is a former Botswana president. He spoke with me from the capital, Habaroni. The Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, or SPLMIO, says it has yet to receive official notification which will allow its leader, Dr. Riek Machar, free movement. Pok Both Balwang, the Director for Information and Public Relations for the SPLMIO, says it is unfortunate for IGAD, the regional bloc, to continue to impose restrictions on Dr. Machar. IGAD imposed travel restrictions on Dr. Machar after he was accused by the administration in Juba of attempting a coup to overthrow the government, an accusation he denies. Meanwhile, Pok Both Balwang says the SPLMIO is committed to the peace agreement even as it anticipates the move to leave the travel
travel restrictions imposed on its leader.
Well, it's a very joyful news if it's true, but we have not been notified officially by the IGAD regarding this information. But according to the last the IGAD ordinary summit, that the issue or the status of Dr. Riek Machar has been deferred to the next ordinary summit that will take place in Khartoum, which is the date has not been set yet, but we have not been notified by the IGAD on his release or this news.
Is the SPLM-IO happy or pleased with the recent meeting you had with President Salva Kiir and were your concerns addressed?
The meetings that have been conducted between the two principals here in Juba, they are fruitful somehow, especially in term of the implementation of the security arrangements. The government has dispatched $16 million out of the $40 million declared by them last month. And we hope that now the mechanisms will expedite their work to implement the work or the activities during this 70 days, or less than 70 days, we say. Now we think, yes, there's a little bit breakthrough regarding these issues, but we're hoping that the government, firstly, to release the remaining fund for the implementation of the critical outstanding issues, and as well to adhere to what's been agreed by the two principals during the last establishment of the National Fund for the implementation of the agreement, which is it will be transparent and accountable, and as they agreed by them, the formation of the government depends on the progress of the implementation of the outstanding critical issues. So we hope that the government will abide by the outcome of the two meetings so that we can move forward regarding the implementation of the agreement, so that we form the government when all the critical issues has been addressed and implemented.
Would you say that what you have seen so far following the meeting between Dr. Riek Machar and President Salva Kiir is a commitment, a political will to finally address all concerns in anticipation of the full implementation of the revitalized peace agreement to give respite to South Sudanese to end this conflict?
Our part as the SPLM, SPLM-IO, we are committed and we have reiterated our full commitment to the implementation of the revitalized agreement in letter and spirit, because we believe it's the only sole way to attain sustainable peace in our country and can leave the huge burden on the shoulders of our people. But after the meeting, we have not noticed any concrete evidence that shows the government will having a political will. But now the ball is in their court to prove to the people of South Sudan and the international community that they adhere to implement this peace agreement. But we urge them actually to commit and have a political will to implement this agreement, because our people now are suffering, and only through the peace that we can achieve as sustainable, and we can revitalize our economy and the social fabric, and can achieve reconciliation, and the IDPs can go back to their homes, and the refugees can return to their country, so that we can help all of us as South Sudanese to rebuild the country that we collectively as political allies work or to participate in their destruction. So now it's part of us to be part of the solution because we were part of the problem.
Pope Booth Balwang is the SPLM-IO Director for Information and Public Relations. He spoke with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. The leader of the Guinean opposition Liberal Bloc Party says civil society and other opposition groups will use all the tools available to resist attempts by the government to amend the constitution. Dr. Faya Melimuno says it is illegal for President Alpha Conde and his government to amend the constitution so he can seek additional terms in office. His remarks come after President Conde announced there is an ongoing draft of the document underway. However, opposition and civil society groups say any changes will be a coup and could plunge the country into chaos. Opposition Liberal Bloc Party leader Dr. Faya Melimuno tells me opponents of the government will continue with effort to stop any attempt to alter the constitution.
Yeah, it is a constitutional coup because the current constitution of this country doesn't allow the president to ask any question about the laicity, for example, of the Republic of Guinea, to ask any question to the Guinean people about the term and the number of terms a president can stand for. So those are the points in the constitution that cannot be changed. He has pledged to respect that constitution. And today, because a small group of people brought the debate as to say, we want a new constitution. In fact, they don't want a new constitution. You cannot come to a country and say, I'm going to trash the constitution that you have now to create a new constitution.
What are opposition groups going to do about this? Because as the president said, the articles are being considered or being written to amend the constitution that will pave way for him to seek additional terms.
We are going to prevent that from happening. There won't be any referendum in this country on changing the whole constitution. The only thing they want is to have that referendum and say, okay, now we have a brand new constitution and we have a brand new country, so we cannot take into account the current constitution. That's the only game they're playing. We're not going to allow that in this country. We went through the change of the constitution to have a president have more than two terms in the past, and that country went bankrupt. We lost about 600 young people in the crisis that the country faced. Now, that's not going to be allowed. That's why we announced clearly that we're going to take the streets, and from now on, we consider that he's no longer legitimate.
How do you do that? How are you going to stop the government from going ahead with a referendum? What tools do you have to stop? And how do you say that he is no longer legitimate when he was elected by the people of Guinea as the legitimate president of Guinea until his term expires early next year?
When you are elected as a president, there are things that you're not allowed to do. Even in the United States of America, when the president does something that is not allowed by the constitution, he can be impeached. In this country, we have also a provision when the president acts beyond what the constitution has allowed him to do, he can be impeached. So we are going to use all the tools, and more importantly, we're going to take the streets, because it happened in Africa before. That's not the first time we are seeing people playing those kind of games. It happened in Burkina Faso some years ago when the guy said he has the right to change the constitution to look for another term. People of Burkina Faso took the street. Today, he is an asylum in Africa. We're going to do the same here. We're not going to allow anybody in this country again to have more than two terms as the president.
Does that mean that you are going to clash with security agents? Because the government, as you are aware, has the security apparatus at its disposal. Will your supporters, opposition supporters combine, clash with the police and thereby undermine Guinea's territorial integrity, peace and stability? Is that what you are advocating?
What I'm saying is, in any country, the security forces are not allowed to follow an order that is illegal. When the president goes beyond the boundary allowed by the Constitution, he's no longer legitimate. So there is no security forces that can follow the order he may give. He may give the order to those security forces to use violence against people. That's not going to make us give up. We're going to fight in the security forces. We believe that they are people who are attached to the value of this republic, to the Constitution, the respect of the Constitution. So since the president is the one who went beyond what is allowed by the Constitution, we think that he can no longer give any order, and nobody is obligated to follow an order he may be giving that is illegal.
Dr. Faye Milimino is the leader of Guinean opposition Liberal Bloc Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Conakry. Nigerian lawmakers are considering two bills that will regulate speech on the internet and on social media platforms. Supporters of the bill say they are aimed at eliminating hate speech and the spread of falsehoods. But opponents say they will stifle free expression and make it a crime to crystallize and criticize public policies or officials. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
A coalition of civic and human rights groups gathered outside Nigeria's National Assembly on Thursday to protest the so-called Social Media Bill and the Prohibition of Hate Speech Bill. A group of lawmakers introduced the measures in November and said the aim was to eliminate internet falsehoods and extremist ideologies that may threaten national security and dim public confidence in political office holders. But for human rights activist and co-convener of the coalition, Rio Dari, the bills are equally capable of stifling free opinions.
These two bills will continue to also hamper, you know, the right of Nigerians to speak their mind. And something is also very important. And we used to have the judiciary in Nigeria as the last hope of the common man. Currently, even the judiciary has been annexed by the current executive in Nigeria. So the last hold and the last hope of the common man today is the social media, and that's exactly what this one of these two bills intend to.
About one-third of Nigeria's estimated 113 million internet users have active social media accounts, and for years these accounts have been used to speak freely against unfavorable public policies and government officials. If the social media law is passed, offenders would pay about $825 or serve a 3-year jail term, while hate speech offenders could meet even stiffer penalties. On the streets of Nigeria's capital, Abuja, resident Divine David says the bills are counterproductive.
I think it's a misguided priority for the government. The government has a lot to bother about right now, beyond trying to frustrate people from expressing their opinion.
Sabi Abdullahi is a Nigerian senator who initiated the hate speech bill. He is determined to see it become law.
If you meet those who have lost their loved ones arising from violence due to ethnicity or religious intolerance and the like, I don't think they will be smiling with you when you tell them hate speech is nonsense.
In recent months, the Nigerian government has been accused by rights groups like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International of moving to restrict political activities like rallies, especially when those gatherings are not in favor of incumbents. Martin Obono is a human rights lawyer.
There are fundamental freedoms within which the Constitution guarantees everybody in Nigeria. So you have freedom of expression, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, and the rest. And now these are all these freedoms. It's all these freedoms that actually make up what is called civic space. Now, if anything affects these freedoms, it automatically means that you're limiting it.
The social media and hate speech bills were given first and second readings at the Senate only weeks after they were proposed, a rare occurrence in Nigeria's legislative process where many bills take months or even years. critics say legislators are fast-tracking the measures to serve their own interests. For now, the bills have been suspended until a public hearing is conducted early next year. But in the meantime, opponents will continue to demand the bills be eliminated. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Libyan National Unity Government based in Tripoli is asking Turkey, the U.S., and several European countries to defend the government. This, as forces loyal to Eastern Military Commander General Khalifa Haftar called on militias fighting in Tripoli and Misrata to lay down their arms. For VOA, Edward Uranian has more from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Forces loyal to Eastern Libyan military commander General Khalifa Haftar exchanged gunfire Friday with militias fighting under the banner of the Tripoli-based National Unity Government south and east of the capital. Libyan fighter jets, also loyal to Haftar, bombed targets and weapons depots inside Misrata and south of the capital. The spokesman for General Haftar's Libyan National Army told journalists Friday that his forces were making preemptive airstrikes against three separate locations near Tripoli that were expected landing points for Turkish military forces. VOA could not independently confirm the claim that Turkish forces were planning to enter the battle. Turkish media nevertheless reported that Libya's unity prime minister, Fayez al-Sarraj, officially activated a November 27 military pact between Ankara and Tripoli, calling for Turkish logistic and military support to prevent the fall of his government. Sarraj also reportedly called on the U.S., Germany, Italy, and Turkey to intervene to protect his government, which is officially recognized by the international community. Despite that recognition, many countries, including France, Russia, Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia, reportedly are supporting General Haftar. Mohammed al-Zubaydi, a Libyan law professor, told Arab media, however, that Sarraj is just calling on the U.S., Germany, and Italy as a fig leaf to cover up his call for Turkish intervention in the Libyan conflict. Haftar's military spokesman, Colonel al-Masmari, claimed that his forces were advancing inside and outside the capital, Tripoli, and called on militias fighting his forces, some of which are based in Misrata, to lay down their arms by midnight Sunday and withdraw peacefully. He says the Libyan National Army is sending a message to the representatives of Misrata to pull out their forces from Tripoli and lay down their arms by midnight Sunday if they do not want to face reprisals or further airstrikes on their city. The Russian Foreign Ministry issued a statement, according to Russian media, saying the possible deployment of Turkish troops in Libya is a source of worry because it could trigger a reaction from neighboring states. Russian President Vladimir Putin said during his annual press conference with journalists Thursday he was in contact with all regional parties to try and end the conflict in Libya. Russia reportedly has mercenaries fighting in Libya on the side of General Haftar. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi told Egyptian media several days ago that Egypt has the capability of intervening in Libya if needed, but has respected diplomatic norms until now by not doing so. Egypt does reportedly help train General Haftar's forces and maintain some of his aging Russian Air Force jets. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Meanwhile, the United Nations Human Rights Office warns conditions in Libya have seriously deteriorated over the past year. This as civilian war casualties multiply and rampant gross violations of human rights escalate, pervading every aspect of Libyan society. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
UN officials describe Libya as a society in total disarray. They say everyone is under attack: civilians, human rights defenders, journalists, migrants, and refugees. They are alarmed at the high number of civilians who have been killed as a result of the armed conflict in Libya. Rebel leader Khalifa Haftar's military forces began an offensive in April to seize the capital, Tripoli. Since then, the UN has documented at least 284 civilian deaths and 363 injuries. Most have been caused by airstrikes, followed by ground fighting, improvised explosive devices, abductions, and killings. UN human rights spokesman Rupert Colville says journalists, media workers, and human rights defenders are subject to violence, threats, and harassment. He says the treatment of migrants and refugees is of particular concern.
They continue to be routinely subjected to violations and abuses, including extrajudicial and arbitrary killings, arbitrary detention, enforced disappearances, torture, sexual and gender-based violence, abduction for ransom, extortion, and forced labor by state officials, traffickers, and by smugglers.
The UN office reports more than 8,600 migrants have been intercepted at sea by the Libyan Coast Guard and returned to Libya this year. Most of them are migrants from sub-Saharan Africa. Every year, thousands of desperately poor Africans make the arduous and deadly journey across the desert to Libya in hopes of reaching Europe and a better life. The migrants who have been intercepted at sea and returned to Libya are among thousands of others who have made the perilous Mediterranean Sea crossing to Italy in fragile smugglers' boats. Many have lost their lives. Colville notes many of those intercepted at sea have been sent to official and unofficial detention centers. There, they are subjected to serious human rights violations and abuses.
We're also concerned that parties to the conflict in Libya continue to store weapons and ammunition in close proximity to civilian locations, particularly detention centers where migrants and refugees are being detained. We remind the parties of their obligation to take all feasible precautions against the effects of attacks.
The UN office reports nearly 9,000 people are being held under extremely abusive, violent, overcrowded conditions in 28 official prisons run by Libya's Ministry of Justice. While conditions in these facilities are extremely bad, it says conditions in unofficial places of detention, many run by armed groups, are likely to be even worse. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from Waiki Benda with Muna Kampala, and then Wawa featuring Luyana will come up with, next with Ella Ella. Nandi follows with Ninogoshi, KC with Limpopo, and then Chris Beats featuring Yemi Alade harmonize with 911 to end it all. Tambuza kanyege nyega wagana ndakumile peke. Music from the continent, we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, producer Saida Hamdoun and our engineer for today, Tiang Wen, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, to try and to fail is not laziness. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.